This is the first of two parts of Chapter 3 of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America by Christian Williams. Chapter 3 is called The Genesis of a Policed Society. In the context of 19th century municipal government, New York's Tammany Hall was exceptionally only in the level of its success. Similar machines emerged in nearly every American city. Powerful neighborhood bosses arose and affiliated, gaining control through a system of patronage and protection, keeping it through increased applications of the same means, and administering civil affairs along lines which were not merely partisan but personalistic as well. Favoritism became the central principle of local government. Quote, "The machine was urban America's outstanding contribution to the art of municipal government. Exemplified by Tammany Hall, it emerged in New York, Philadelphia, and other eastern cities in the early and middle 19th century, and in Chicago, Kansas City, San Francisco, and other western cities not long after. A highly decentralized outfit, the machine was an association of loosely affiliated and largely autonomous ward organizations, whose power depended on their ability to get out the vote on election day. Whether allied with the Democrats, as in New York, the Republicans, as in Philadelphia, or neither party, as for a while in San Francisco, the ward bosses operated in much the same way in most American cities. They gave out contracts to local businessmen, found and, if need be, created jobs for recent immigrants, provided opportunities for aspiring politicians, and otherwise exchanged material inducements for political loyalty. In return for delivering the vote, the ward bosses demanded a good deal to say, not only about the policies of the mayor's offices and city councils, but also about the operations of the police departments and other municipal agencies." Unquote. Under the machines, the resources of the government were the spoils of victory, belonging less to the public than to the reigning faction. Thus, quite removed from the ideal of deliberative democracy, elections were neither contests of principle nor gauges of the public will, but battles between rival cliques, battles fought as often in the streets as at the polls. And these battles determined the distribution of jobs, services, and graft. Elections decided who made the law, supplied public services, and controlled the city treasury. And, more importantly, they decided whose friends would fill public jobs, which neighborhoods would receive attention or suffer neglect, which illicit businesses would continue operation, and whose palm would be greased in the process. Political machines, the gang and the government. The gang and the government are no different. Jane's Addiction. Corruption was the foundation and defining characteristic of the political machine. Edward C. Banfield and James Q. Wilson offer a more formal definition. Quote, "A political machine is a party organization that depends crucially upon inducements that are both specific and material." Unquote. Put more simply, quote, "Machine government is essentially a system of organized bribery." Unquote. But perhaps even this puts too pleasant a face on it, for machines did not use only bribery to get what they wanted. They used whatever means were available to them, including threats, fraud, blackmail, and actual violence. Machines were concerned about power and resources, not principles, and certainly not democracy. Principles were espoused, of course, as justification for their actions to differentiate one party from another, and to gain and maintain the allegiance of a constituency committed to such values. But it was typical of machine politics that principles were always secondary to the demands of power. The privileging of power over principle meant that every aspect of the government's activity was directed towards maintaining the ruling clique's control. By the same token, every resource at the city's disposal was available as a reward for the machine's supporters. The police served in both capacities. Hiring, discipline, transfers, and promotions were all governed by the convenience of the machine organization. Hence, whenever control of the city government changed hands, turnover in the police department was sure to follow. Without regard for the qualifications of the individual officer, each party dispensed with the supporters of the other and replaced them with their own. Very nearly full turnover of police personnel followed the Los Angeles election in 1889, the Kansas City election of 1895, and the Chicago and Baltimore elections of 1897. In the 1907 Louisville election, when a Republican was unexpectedly elected mayor, every captain was reduced to a patrolman, and Republicans, many lacking in police experience, were appointed in their place. When the Democrats won in the following election, the process was reversed. Again, in 1917, the Republicans gained control and fired 300 from a department of 429. Everyone above the rank of sergeant was replaced. In New York, positions were so sought after that appointments relied on political sponsorship or outright bribery, or sometimes both. Hence, from the first moment, the importance of political influence and bribes was made clear to new recruits. A patrolman's position typically sold for $300 and required the approval of the district leader. Higher positions cost more. In 1893, Timothy Creedon paid a commissioner $15,000 to be promoted from sergeant to captain. As a captain's salary was only $3,000 each year, it's obvious that he would need to rely on graft even to pay for his job. Even when civil service tests were instituted in the 1880s, conditions remained largely the same. Politicians circumvented civil service requirements by appointing partisan boards, administering the exams in essay style, or requiring the Civil Service Commission to provide 3 qualified candidates for every open position, and allowing police officials to choose among them. Experiments with state-level police boards proved equally unhelpful. The creation of state boards, a partisan maneuver by design, only transferred the control of patronage from one group to another, as indeed it was intended to do. Likewise, bipartisan boards, rather than eliminating political spoils, merely divided them between the two strongest parties to mutual advantage. Nor did political interference end once an officer was hired. Police with powerful friends proved nearly impossible to discipline, no matter how corrupt, brutal, or negligent they might be. Even such routine matters as going on patrol and wearing uniforms were difficult to enforce. Since each officer's career was politically controlled from beginning to end, the police became ardent supporters of their patrons. Police support was central to the survival of the machines for much of the 19th century. New York's Board of Elections was under the supervision of the police board. The commissioners chose the polling places, drew up the voting districts, had the ballots and voter registration lists printed, and appointed the polling inspectors and clerks. The police department itself verified the registration lists, guarded the polls, and counted the votes. Mayor William R. Grace described this system as, quote, a standing menace to the safety and purity of the ballot box and tending to render the police of the city its masters rather than its servants, unquote. Tammany Police Commissioner John Sheehan once bluntly stated that control of the police was more important than how the votes were cast. This power tended to magnify the significance of the administrative branch and bolstered the influence of the mayor especially. The career of Boston's Josiah Quincy anticipated the trend. Beginning in 1823, Quincy was elected mayor 6 times. In 1829, he was dubbed the Great Mayor, a title which probably reflected the extent of his power more than the quality of his performance. During his term, Quincy chaired every important committee, allowing him to build an efficient administration and, as importantly, consolidate power under his personal leadership. At the same time, Quincy maintained his influence in the wards with the assistance of the nascent police apparatus. Central to this effort was the creation of a new office, Marshal of the City, which, lacking precedent and statutory limits, could be made to fit whatever demands the mayor placed on it. The marshal served as head constable, commanded the night watch, acted as the city's chief health officer, prosecuted minor cases, and took additional responsibilities after the creation of a day police in 1838. The power of the marshal reached its peak during the term of Marshal Francis Tuckey, who took the office in 1846. Within the first year of Tuckey's command, the number of officers on the force was doubled, a detective division added, and a special night force created. But there were limits to how far this power would be allowed to develop. In 1851, the police voted as a block for Benjamin Seaver in the mayoral election, acting under the assumption that he would bar Irish immigrants from joining the force. Seaver won, but did not ban Irish police. Apparently, the night police had crossed a line when they marched to the polls en masse. Seaver responded by firing all the night duty officers, dissolving that branch of the force, and leaving its patrols entirely in the hands of the barely existent night watch. Over the course of the next year, power was systematically moved away from the marshal and toward the mayor and the aldermen. In April 1852, the aldermen limited the marshal's tenure to 1 year. 2 months later, they replaced the position with that of chief of police. While Tuckey was not fired outright, neither was he named the new chief. The Boston Semi-Weekly Atlas drew a comparison, quote, "The great Caesar fell for his ambition," unquote. The lesson was clear. The police were a tool for the political machine. They would not be allowed to develop as a political force in their own right. This balance could be difficult to maintain, though, since police were so central to the functioning of the machines. The police served the interests of political machines in three key ways. Police jobs served as rewards for supporters, police controlled the elections, and police regulated illicit businesses, deciding which would be allowed to operate and under what conditions. Quote, "Contrary to the conventional wisdom, the police did not suppress vice, they licensed it. From New York's Tenderloin to San Francisco's Barbary Coast, and from Chicago's Levee to New Orleans' French Quarter, they permitted gamblers, prostitutes, and saloon keepers to do business under certain well-understood conditions. These entrepreneurs were required to make regular payoffs, which ranged, according to the enterprise and the community, from a few dollars to a few $100s per month, and to stay inside the lower and lower middle class neighborhoods," unquote. In this way, vice laws and liquor laws especially proved a useful tool for political machines to enhance their power. Protection money provided a source of funding, and selective enforcement allowed political bosses to discipline their supporters and put their competitors out of business. In New York, precinct captains used detectives to collect protection money. In other places, the landlord would collect it as part of the rent, then pass it on to the police. He would say to the proprietor of the saloon or brothel, "You can have this house for $200 with police protection, or $100 if you take care of yourself." Police detectives, like the thief-takers before them, were more interested in retrieving stolen property and collecting rewards than in catching crooks. Of course, the easiest way to get hold of stolen goods was to work with the thieves. In exchange for immunity and a portion of the reward, thieves would supply detectives with their loot. The detectives would return the stolen items to the rightful owners, minus whatever the sum they claimed as a reward. Many professional criminals would not work outside of such a framework, and these deals could be quite profitable for the cops. Between January 1, 1855 and April 30, 1857, Robert Bowyer of the New York Police Department earned $4,700 in rewards, more than twice his salary for the same period. Sometimes, no effort would be made to retrieve the stolen property or to return it to the victim. Pickpockets and con artists were generally allowed to go about their business unmolested so long as they cut the cops in on the action. The profits then worked their way up the political food chain. The cops were required to give a portion of their take to the commanders, the local politicians, and their affiliates, thus avoiding any punishment. Shakedowns weren't restricted to illicit enterprises either. Legitimate businesses could also be inconvenienced by strict enforcement of law and were vulnerable to the disruption caused by routine harassment. Builders, bootblacks, produce merchants, and other peddlers had to pay off the beat cop or else they might be taken in for blocking the sidewalks. The system of bribery and extortion that was the 19th century policing far surpassed anything that could be termed individual misconduct or even organizational deviance. It resembled nothing so much as an institutionalized corruption, state-sponsored crime. Graft and the abuse of power were not merely allowed, they were expected, required, and enforced within the police department and throughout the city administration. The political machine may be best understood as an exercise in government of, by, and for corruption. This fusion of government and criminality follows a certain kind of logic. In War Making and the State Making as Organized Crime, Charles Tilly argues that, quote, "Banditry, piracy, gangland rivalry, policing, and war making all belong on the same continuum. Consider the definition of a racketeer as someone who creates a threat and then charges for its reduction. Government's provision of protection by this standard often qualifies as racketeering. To the extent that threats against which a given government protects its citizens are imaginary or are the consequences of its own activities, the government has organized a protection racket," unquote. The history of American cities gives concrete expression to Tilly's theoretical claim. In the classic political machines, government agencies and organized criminal enterprises were not only moral equivalents, they often comprised the same people. 19th century policing did not just resemble racketeering, it was racketeering, unmistakably. The police were a central component of this system. Both the protection schemes that ensured the cooperation of the underworld and the brawling gangs that controlled polls on election day relied on, at the very least, the acquiescence of the police. In many respects, the development of the political machines depended on the simultaneous development of the modern police. At the same time, the modernization of policing made possible important advances in municipal government. In particular, the police provided the means by which the power of local government could be consolidated into a single coherent system. In this respect, the rise of political machines resembled the earlier rise of the state itself. A brief comparison of these processes may tell us something about the engineering of power and the uses of policing in establishing its claims. In general terms, we can discern a common principle underlying the creation of local political machines and that of national states. Quote, "A tendency to monopolize the means of violence makes a government's claim to provide protection, in either the comforting or ominous sense of the word, more credible and more difficult to resist." Unquote. Tilly further identifies four activities characteristic of states. 1. Making war, defeating external rivals. 2. Making states, destroying internal rivals. 3. Protection, defending clients from their enemies. And 4. Extraction, acquiring the resources to do the other three. Cities have not, since the colonial period, usually been forced to contend with external rivals, and thus have not been concerned with making war. But the other three activities find clear analogies in the activities of city governments, especially during the machine period. And at both the national and the municipal levels, quote, "all these activities depend on the state's tendency to monopolize the concentrated means of coercion," unquote. Philadelphia's history illustrates some more specific parallels. In the first half of the 19th century, urban growth had spread beyond the city's jurisdiction, practically uniting it with nearby townships over which it had no authority. The urban area was divided between several municipalities, and these were divided geographically into neighborhoods, politically into wards, and socially along religious and ethnic lines, with a strong correlation between these sets of divisions. It was nearly impossible to keep order. Catholics and Protestants fought in the streets, white mobs attacked black people and abolitionist speakers, and the city government could do practically nothing even within the limited area of its authority. The localized, ward-based system of city politics inhibited the government's ability to enforce its will within the neighborhoods. Yet, in the course of a few years, Philadelphia was transformed from a fragmented megalopolis with only a nominal central authority to a modern city with a unified city government, a citywide political machine, and a police system to enforce the will of each. Much of the disorder in 19th century Philadelphia was perpetrated, oddly, by the city's volunteer fire departments. Neighborhood-based fire companies adopted the ethnic and religious identities of their members, and often saw themselves as the champions of their neighborhood's traditional culture and honor. Firefighting became a source of neighborhood pride, and offered an opportunity to settle scores against rival groups. Demographic shifts and overlapping jurisdictions led to frequent turf wars. Firemen would often fight one another while a blaze continued unabated. When opportunities for battle did not present themselves, they were sometimes created. Fire companies would set fires in other precincts and then ambush their rivals. These brawls became neighborhood affairs involving large sections of the community. Many of the fire companies affiliated with youth gangs, some with names like Killers, Rats, and Bouncers. As the police at the time were also organized into separate ward organizations, they were ill-suited for suppressing such riots. Not that they were eager to either, the cops generally felt little inclination to interfere with these battles except in support of their neighborhood company. This situation put conflicting pressures on the political system. On the one hand, it created demands for more centralization, for government-run fire departments and a single police force capable of suppressing disorder. On the other hand, ward leaders saw the political potential of the fire companies and were quick to avail themselves of this additional source of election day muscle. The balkanized state of the city therefore left local political bosses in a bit of a bind. Their personal fiefdoms were inextricably tied to the ward-based structure of government. It allowed them a distinct realm of influence and a base of support for pursuing their agenda in the citywide political arena. But the exercise of this authority relied on a certain minimum degree of public order, which this same ward structure, with its rivalries and fragmentation, constantly threatened. The outcome of this dilemma is revealing. In 1850, a Marshal's police force was created for the entire city of Philadelphia. Police in the suburbs and the four city districts continued to act independently, but were also called on to cooperate with the Marshal's force. The first Marshal, John Kaiser, recruited the new police directly from the youth gangs associated with nativist fire departments, reasoning that he could form a, quote, strong-armed force prepared to slug it out with fire gangs, unquote. By co-opting the most militant element of the fire companies and consolidating them into a single citywide force, the Marshal's police organization afforded new cops the opportunity to defeat their traditional rivals and greatly enhanced the power of the city government, as well as, for a time, that of the nativist party machine. Catholic gangs and fire companies, while overpowered, were not especially impressed with their rivals' new authority. One gang, the Bleeders, told in a song of being attacked by a, quote, band of ruffians, they called themselves police, unquote. And when the nativists lost control of the city government, Kaiser's replacement, a Democrat, filled the force with Democrats, also recruited from the fire company gangs. In 1854, the legislature revised the city's charter to cover the entire contiguous urban area, incorporating outlying districts into the city. The new charter required a centralized police department and allowed for a city-controlled fire department as well. The mayor was given the power to appoint police officers and set the department's rules, and the city council was responsible for determining the size and organization of the force. The council created an 820-man department, divided between 14 precincts corresponding to the ward districts. One alderman was elected to serve as magistrate in each district, and a single marshal was appointed to oversee the entire operation. In effect, this arrangement put the new police directly in the service of the reigning political machine. But the consolidation of power may not have been everything the ward leaders had hoped for. In many respects, the beginnings of a central authority relied on a corresponding decline in local power. The survival of the central power structure demanded the eventual elimination of its potential rivals. So long as local political bosses could command their own sources of power, the central government as a whole was necessarily vulnerable. Again, we find a parallel with the creation of the nation-state. Quote, in one way or another, every European government before the French Revolution relied on indirect rule via local magnates. The magnates collaborated with the government without becoming officials in any strong sense of the term, had some access to government-backed force, and exercised wide discretion within their own territories. Yet, the same magnates were potential rivals, possible allies of a rebellious people. Eventually, European governments reduced their reliance on interest rule but on indirect rule by means of two expensive but effective strategies, A, extending their officialdom to the local community, and B, encouraging the creation of police forces that were subordinate to the government rather than to individual patrons, distinct from war-making forces, and therefore less useful as the tools of dissident magnates, unquote. Likewise, in Philadelphia, as long as the central government was dependent upon the cooperation of the ward bosses, the government's influence was quite limited, and no one faction could be assured of permanent dominance. Faced with difficulties resembling those of the early European states, Philadelphia's local government followed a similar course. Quote, in England, Tudor determinalization of the great lords entailed four complementary campaigns, eliminating their personal bands of armed retainers, raising their fortresses, taming their habitual resort to violence for the settlement of disputes, and discouraging the cooperation of their dependents and tenants. Unquote. In Philadelphia, all four aims were accomplished with one master stroke. The creation of a citywide police force allowed the limited consolidation of the city government. the ward-based militants were either co-opted into the police or defeated by them. While no fortresses existed to be pulled down, the ward leaders were made increasingly vulnerable politically. Their position came to depend as much on their status within the machine citywide as on their influence in their own ward. Inter-ward battles were either avoided by the new system or forcibly resolved by the new police. And the cooperation and loyalty of ward residents, once owed to their local boss, became attached to the new citywide machine. Philadelphia did not become a nation-state, of course, or even a city-state, but the authority of the city's government was produced by very similar means, and in this process, the creation of modern policing played a central role. The new police were not simply one aspect of a modernizing city government. They also represented a means of consolidating power within the modernizing government. But as the city consolidated power, it embarked on the first of a series of adaptations that would strengthen the government itself at the expense of the local leaders, eventually leading to the decline of the machine system. Centralization, even in meager form, not only changed the distribution of power, but also tended to transform the institutions that shared power. The modernization of the police allowed for a major advance in the organization and efficiency of the political machine, and with it the power of municipal government. With a single police force in place, power could be, if not quite centralized, at least somewhat solidified. This step proved a major boon to the reigning machine, and provided one means for the machine to exert influence in wards where popular support was weak. As it did, however, it began the process by which control was shifted both upward and toward the center. Inadvertently, the creation of a citywide police force both drew up the blueprint and laid the groundwork for the creation of other municipal bureaucracies, and the eventual destruction of the ward-based machine system. While somewhat ironic, this turn of events represents a continuation of the trends that had shaped the development of law enforcement as it approached the modern period, specifically the growing emphasis on prevention, the tendency to expand police duties, and the move toward specialized agencies. Each of these factors contributed to the process of modernization, but the ideal of prevention occupied a special place as a guiding principle of police development. The preventive ideal, generalized powers, and specialization. The idea of preventing crime has long been the avowed aim of policing, but it has undergone significant revision over time. In the London Night Watch Acts of 1737 and 1738, crime prevention was explicitly cited as the goal of the watch, though it is unclear how the body was supposed to contribute to this aim. The instructions offered in the Philadelphia Watch in 1791 were only slightly more explicit. Quote, "The said constable and watchmen, in their respective turns and courses of watching, shall use their best endeavors to prevent murders, burglaries, robberies, and other outrages and disorders within the city, and to that end shall, and they are hereby empowered and required, to arrest and apprehend all persons whom they shall find disturbing the peace, or shall have cause to suspect of any unlawful and evil design." Unquote. By 1800, the preventive rationale had been refined. The watch's role was to ensure that criminals would be punished. To this end, in 1794, the St. Mary Le Bon Watch Committee resolved unanimously, quote, "that in case any robbery be committed within the parish, the watchmen in those walk, the same shall happen, be absolutely discharged." Unquote. Several other London districts adopted a similar standard, though eventually the limits of the system had to be admitted. A few months later, St. Mary Le Bon Committee relented, acknowledging that, quote, "many robberies are committed within this parish without the possible knowledge of the watchmen." Unquote. Watchmen were thought to deter crime by their mere presence, and they could detain people they suspected of criminal acts, but the watch was not a detective force and had no means for discovering the culprits after a crime was committed. The odds, then, were against apprehension. While the idea behind the watch was preventive, the watch's methods were essentially reactive, and even their reactive capabilities were quite limited. When Robert Peel created the London Metropolitan Police in 1829, the prevention of crime was singled out as the new body's chief concern. Quote, It should be understood at the outset that the principal object to be attained is the prevention of crime. To this great end, every effort of the police is to be directed. The security of person and property, the preservation of the public tranquility, and all the other objects of police establishment will thus be better affected than by the detection and punishment of the offender, after he has succeeded in committing the crime." Unquote. Nevertheless, the Metropolitans remained unsure of how to prevent crime. In the decades that followed, they essentially replicated the patrols of the watch, with even less success. In the U.S., quote, "the term preventive police was used frequently and loosely. Preventive seemed to mean that by their presence the police would inhibit the commission of crime, and that they would deal with potentially serious crimes before they reached the crisis stage." Unquote. This crude notion of prevention developed into a more serious and ambitious program as time passed, and came to inform the expansion of police powers. In Boston, for example, in 1850, the police were authorized to order any group of three or more people to move on or suffer arrest. Of course, most of what the police did was still responsive, and most actual crime fighting still took place after the crimes had been committed. But the preventive ideal was clearly gaining an articulation, and slowly, techniques were developed to bring the practice closer to the principle. The preventive ideal both prompted the expansion of police power and helped shape the specialized focus on crime. It's worth noting the tension between these two trends. If police powers expand over too large a range of duties, policing loses its character. The police come to resemble generalized inspectors, and enforcement of the criminal law becomes a secondary matter. But if enforcement is overly specialized, the police are in effect replaced by a series of guards, traffic wardens, thief takers, bounty hunters, and whatnot. Constables, sheriffs, and marshals, as servants of the court or sovereign, were assigned general responsibilities. The slave patrols developed from the other end of the spectrum, beginning with a few select duties and accumulating responsibilities and power over time. The second path was the more straightforward route toward modernization, because rather than serving primarily as officers to the crown or the court, the slave patrols existed solely as a means of preserving the status quo through the enforcement of the slave codes. As soon as they separated from the militia, they became law enforcement bodies, and new duties were added accordingly. The tension between specialization and generalization did not vanish with the creation of the modern police. The police retained many duties that were quite remote from their alleged purpose of preventing crime and enforcing the criminal law. Robert Fogelson explains, quote, "In the absence of other specialized public bureaucracies, the authorities found the temptation almost irresistible to transform the police departments into catch-all health, welfare, and law enforcement agencies. Hence, the police cleaned streets and inspected boilers in New York, distributed supplies to the poor in Baltimore, accommodated the homeless in Philadelphia, investigated vegetable markets in St. Louis, operated emergency ambulances in Boston, and attempted to curb crime in all these cities." Unquote. In fact, even today, the police continue to hold duties quite removed from the enforcement of law and the prevention of crime. In many cities, cops still direct traffic, license parades, escort funerals, remove panhandlers, quiet loud parties, find lost children, advise urban planners, make presentations to civic groups and school children, operate Boys and Girls Clubs, and perform other tasks quite outside their stated purview. As Fogelson implies, this tendency developed in part because the police offered a means for the local government to enforce its will, regulate the behavior of its citizens, and generally keep an eye on things with unprecedented efficiency and regularity. It thus became a constant temptation to use this power in new and expanding ways, often to the detriment of the specialized law enforcement function. Further specialization then relied on the development of additional bureaucracies to take on these extraneous duties. Quote, "The police were valued especially for the flexibility which made them adaptable to new demands, but when better machinery was developed, the government did not hesitate to transfer their responsibilities. The creation of the sewer, health, street, and building departments all diminished the role of the police in local administration." Unquote. Policing is thus tied to a more general trend in government administration, the rise of bureaucracies. the development of modern police both depended on and prompted the creation of other municipal bureaucracies. In the first place, the creation of other bureaucracies allowed the police to specialize. Second, the consolidation of police forces facilitated a more general move towards bureaucratization by providing a model for these same bureaucracies to adopt. For both of these reasons, the modernization of the police was a key component in the modernization of city government. But the impact of the new police was not restricted to its effect on municipal administration. Policing was also closely connected to the economic conditions attending widespread industrialization and the consequent expansion of the cities themselves. That is it for the first half of Chapter 3.